Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did. We started to burn many things we found, too many things we found, as a matter of fact, including frack gas, which we'll talk about in a minute. I have a fantastic guest for the full hour today, one of the great experts in renewable energy and solartopian transition, Paul Geip, talking to us. Paul, you're in Indiana, is that right?
Yeah, I'm in the great state of Indiana, correct.
What are you doing there?
I'm visiting family for the holidays.
Oh, all right. That's good. That's cool. So
This is a state that needs a Solartopia, I can tell you.
Boy, it needs a lot more than that, but at least they have a good basketball team. Paul Geip is one of the great pioneers of the renewable energy industry. I remember seeing his smiling, happy face with his very long hair way back when, probably in the late 60s, as a matter of fact. And now we're in our late 60s. But that's the way it goes. But, Paul, you're still based in Bakersfield, right?
Correct. I'm based in the heart of California's oil country.
Right. And Bakersfield also was once going to be the site of a dozen, count them, a dozen nuclear power plants until somebody pointed out a small problem, which is that there's no water to cool them. We did kill those 12. Otherwise, you'd have been right there. You could have got radiated 24/7 right there in Bakersfield. Now it takes
yep.
a little longer for
and
the radiation.
There's even some more good news we can discuss about Bakersfield.
Well, let's hear it. Let's start right on.
Let's talk about it. Bakersfield was the site of a proposed carbon sequestration plant, a giant multi-billion-dollar coal-burning plant that would use carbon sequestration to help extract oil in the western Kern County oil fields, and it was canceled this week.
Wow. As they say in the energy business, mazel tov. How did it get canceled? Did the people rise up to fight it?
The people did rise up to fight it, even the conservative farmers of western Kern County, who never saw a progressive that they could tolerate, found that they could form an alliance with people like the Sierra Club and oppose this coal plant that was going to be built in one of the most air-polluted places in the United States. It's unimaginable that they actually would have proposed this thing. At the same time, you know, this is a technology that's not there, it's not ready, and despite almost a $500 million subsidy that was laying on the table by the Department of Energy and the Obama administration, of course, they couldn't make the project work. It was just one fiasco after another, trying to find somebody who would buy, first, the carbon dioxide, secondly, buy the electricity from the power plant. They just couldn't make the deal work. And finally, the California Energy Commission said, you know, enough is enough. This thing has been going on for years. It's time to call it a quits. If you have a real proposal, come back to us.
So did you have a big party with all these right-wing farmers and left-wing hippies that got together?
It would be quite entertaining. I'm sure the Bakersfield, California should feature it on the front page.
Well, I'm sure there'd be quite a bit of medicinal marijuana at such a party, don't you think?
That's on the eastern side of the county. No, the western side, they don't smoke that stuff.
Oh, don't kid yourself. Do not kid yourself. I got a friend who went into rural Ohio in the early 70s, and he was a botanist, and he wanted to study all the great plants that grow in southeastern Ohio, which is actually quite an ecological cornucopia there. And he went in there with his long hair, and he was plowing with oxen, for God's sakes. And all the locals, they actually shot at him. And then he became a folk hero. And among all the farmers, they couldn't love him more. And guess what he did? Guess why he's a folk hero? He taught them how to grow pot. And then by growing pot, first of all, they lowered their alcohol bill, but they also saved their farms. And so I will guarantee you, Paul Geitz, that a lot of the people in the so-called redneck areas of Southern California do imbibe in that medicinal marijuana stuff. I mean, it's way more prevalent than anybody wants to think.
The good news is, whether they're smoking dope or not, is that the California Energy Commission ordered a cancellation of the plant. The plant has not been built. They only spent $150 million on the paperwork to do the plant, but the plant has been canceled, and that follows, of course, the good news that came out of Paris. And so I think the message of your show today is that there is momentum towards the solartopia that you've been talking about for so many years.
Well, let's talk about that, Paul. Were you in Paris?
No, I wasn't in Paris. I'd have loved to have been there, but no, I didn't really have any reason to be in Paris. There are a lot of good people trying to do good work there, and they didn't need me.
Well, see, I was in Paris, Texas at the time, and that was... but I couldn't find anybody to talk about climate change. So you of course, the Paris Accord has gotten mixed reviews. Some people think this, some people think that. But Paul Geipe, as really one of the world's leading experts on renewable energy, and I say that really advisedly because I know a lot of them, but you're at the top of the heap. So tell me, what do you think of what happened in Paris?
Well, it's not just what I think. It's what others think, too. Sometimes you have to step back and say, what are our enemies saying? And one of the things that our enemies are saying, I saw today in the newspaper here in central Indiana, the Anderson Herald has a column by one of the right-wing writers you see in newspapers all across the United States, and he was just lambasting Paris as an absolute waste of time, absolute disaster, nothing of consequence came from it. And I read it just the opposite, saying, they must have really accomplished something.
Who was it? Do you want to name this person?
Richard Lowry. Yeah, Richard Lowry.
Okay. There's so many of them. I think it's just one computer-generated thing, and then they put different names on it and send it around, you know?
Well, let me give you another example, Harvey, is that the head of the European Coal Association said after this conference, we are going to be looked down upon as though we were slave traders. And I thought, yeah, that's an appropriate way to express it.
Yeah. Well, that's an understatement. I mean, at least the slave trade didn't affect the climate. So tell me the specifics. What do you think was really accomplished in Paris?
And that's where, you know, the critics have a legitimate argument. In the terms of the specifics, there's very little specifics that was accomplished in Paris, and I think all of us will have to agree to that. But what's overlooked when you try to seek out what specific thing did they agree to do is the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is they had a conference on climate, and all these nations got together and said, oh, we do have a problem. And consider that leading up to this, there has been a concerted campaign for, what, two decades now to say, what, me worry there's no problem, or if there's a problem, it's not important, or if there is a problem, it's not man-caused, or if there's a problem, there's nothing we can do about it. These nations came together, so diverse, from China to the United States to Saudi Arabia, came together and said, we do have a problem, and we do need to do something about it. And yes, that's not something specific, but it is a statement. It's a statement that we do need to take action. And the other thing that's important for observers to note is that this signaled the end of the Kyoto Agreement. The Kyoto Agreement was based on this concept that was cooked up in the trading boardrooms of Wall Street and London and in Frankfurt, of a cap-and-trade system, a worldwide cap-and-trade system.
And yeah, can you, You know, I've always thought that cap and trade, since it was complicated and I didn't understand, was probably terrible. So can you briefly explain what cap and trade has been? I mean, I prefer to use the past tense, what cap and trade was, but there are some people still clinging to it. I think the Chinese still use cap and trade. Can you tell us a bit, Paul Guype, about what cap and trade really is and then why it's inferior to other ways of getting at climate change?
Well, before I do, let me finish the thought is, and that is what it said was that we will do have to address climate change, and that this idea of the cap and trade is not something that needs to be implemented on a global scale to accomplish the results of addressing climate change, that there are many different things we can do, and that things that we can do, such as developing renewable energy, for example, and that there was a general consensus that renewable energy is the future. And we could go back to cap and trade in a moment, but the main thing was that came from this is a sentiment, and it's a sentiment throughout the media, is that renewable energy is now, that the solartopia is not today, but the movement towards what you call solartopia is well and truly underway, finally.
Well, that's great. I mean, I did see in the media some of the financial reports that said that immediately after Paris, the renewable energy stocks went way, way up and coal stocks went way down.
Yeah, well, one of the messages from Paris is that coal is dead. And I think what prompted you to ask me on your program again was the things that just happened in the run-up to Paris as nations and states and provinces tried to step out and say, oh, we need to go to Paris with something in our hands. And, for example, I think I sent around a note that you picked up on that the province of Alberta and Alberta, Canada, the province of Alberta, Canada, officially announced they were going to close all their coal plants by 2025, and that they were going to cap the emissions from the oil sands. Now, of course, the details are, of course, a little murky, but this is Alberta, the oil capital of Canada, one of the centers of the growth, the future growth, the expected growth in oil production in the world was centered on Alberta. And Alberta knew that if they went to Paris that people were going to attack their oil industry. So to protect the oil industry, they decided to sacrifice the coal industry. And this is what we see happening. And this is something that's not just in Alberta. So shortly after Alberta made this announcement, the province of Saskatchewan, and you can hardly get more conservative than Alberta and Saskatchewan. So Saskatchewan said, well, we're going to have a 50% renewable energy by 2025 or 2030. It doesn't make any difference. And this is Saskatchewan. And these are things that were statements that were made leading up to the Paris conference. So it's very, very encouraging. Yes, this is just hot air. These things have to all be implemented. But it's politicians. It's the public, it's a process that's saying we need to close the coal plants, we need to develop renewable energy, and despite all the propaganda that we have been fed worldwide, but primarily in the English-speaking countries for the last two decades, we need to close the coal plants, we need to do something about global warming.
I'm talking with Paul Guype here, world-renowned expert on renewables. Paul, what's your website real quick?
Wind-works.org, WIND-works.org, windworks.org.
So since you raised it, how exactly are Alberta and Saskatchewan going to implement the phase out of coal? Do they have a specific legislative track they're going to follow? Well, where's the teeth to this?
Well, this goes back to your question about cap and trade. One of the possibilities, in fact, the words being used in Alberta is they will place a tax on carbon. And they may participate in the cap and trade program in North America, but they specifically use the words they'll place a tax on carbon. So British Columbia has a tax on carbon. This is another way of approaching how do you discourage the use of fossil fuels? How do you make fossil fuels, the burning combustion of fossil fuels, pay for its social and environmental costs? And one of the ideas of economists is that you place a tax on it. Cap and trade is a whole other system, but it's much more direct and much more straightforward. Something that I support is placing a tax directly on the combustion of fossil fuels, and this is what Alberta has proposed doing, and that's different than what, say, the province of Ontario or the state of California has done, which is entered into a cap and trade program.
Well, that's interesting. One of our previous guests has been the great Charles Komanoff, who runs the Carbon Tax Institute and has really been a major advocate of carbon tax for a long, long time. And so to hear that Alberta would put in a carbon tax is a pretty big deal.
It's a huge deal in North America where Charles has been not the only person, but Charles is the most eloquent spokesman for the concept as an economist, as someone who has analyzed the energy industry for, three decades more. He is the person, as you said, who you can go to for information on what is a carbon tax and what does it mean. But that's not been the mainstream. He's been on the outside, and so there's a few of us, Charles and myself and others, who propose a different approach, and carbon tax is one of those. And the reason it's not so popular is it's so direct. It's so straightforward. If we believe that burning fossil fuels, coal and petroleum, natural gas, for example, has these environmental effects, then we should just say that you got to pay for it. But when you say you have to pay for it, that means you have to put a price on it. And that means somebody has to make a decision. And politicians typically don't like to make such a decision because it's going to increase the cost. So what Alberta has done, which is what we have suggested, people like Charles have suggested for many years, they say, we're going to put a tax on coal. We're going to put a tax on fossil fuels, but it's going to be reimbursed to you, the people. You're going to have to pay more, okay, but you're going to get the money back at the end of the year. You're going to get a rebate. You're going to get a tax rebate from the money that you paid in for the carbon that's being emitted by your car or the power plants that supply you electricity. And when you pay at the pump or when you buy your electricity, you know, you're going to pay more, and so that's uncomfortable. But it does mollify the concern somewhat to say you're going to get a check at the end of the year, and a check is to compensate you for what you've paid. It still discourages you from using that that fossil fuel because you can decide whether you want to burn fossil fuels or not because it's going to cost more. So we're putting a price. If we believe in this market system that, you know, we live in and in Western society, then you have to have a price that reflects its cost to society, and we haven't done that. And so one of the reasons politicians don't like to do that, they don't like to stand up. But in Alberta, they have a new government, and a new government came in, and they can change things. And they said, okay, this is what we're going to do. And the other guys didn't do it because they were wed to the coal industry. We're not. We're the other guys. So we're going to tax carbon, and then we're going to pay you back at the end of the year. And that's
amazing,
so different
actually
than what California has done.
Well, what has California done?
California has created
California
a cap and trade. Go ahead.
All right, so let's get into this cap and trade thing because, you know, it's been out there for a long time. It's got a kind of a green aura about it, but everything I've read about it says it sucks. So tell us about cap and trade in general and in California in particular.
Well, to understand cap and trade, you have to understand the philosophy. In fact, the religion has dominated Western thought for the last three decades of neoliberalism, and that is the principle of cap and trade is you allow a market, you create a market, this mystical thing that somehow will allocate resources, that's money, to do the tasks that you want to do. So you create a market in carbon, and you've set a limit on the amount of carbon that has to, that can be emitted. And if a company can't meet those limits, say a power plant, they can buy carbon permits from somebody else. But they have to buy them from somebody else, which means they have to trade in carbon permits. And when you use the word trade, that implies a broker. And what does a broker do? A broker charges a commission. So you immediately say, oh, I know who's going to like this system, the broker. And who are the brokers? Goldman Sachs, some of the biggest names in finance, are the people who push and support this concept of carbon trading, because they're the ones who are going to profit. And there's no indication, there's, you know, we can make carbon trading work because we have all these out-of-work attorneys in the United States. We can put them to work drafting all the regulations to make carbon trading function in the way we want, but there are people who really benefit the most from it. Not society in general, but it's the traders who are trading the carbon credits from one to the other. So people like me, you know, simple people, say, I just don't understand how that works. That's so complex. Why don't we just tax it? And that's why
That's the point. Where does the cap come in? What's the cap?
Well, that's true. The politicians have to set the cap. But the cap is much different than saying we are going to tax gasoline at so many cents a gallon, and that's pretty clear. All of us understand that. But if you say, well, we're going to make a ton of carbon cost $35, I mean, how many of us know what that means? So a politician can say so many dollars per ton per carbon, but so many tons of carbon can be emitted by this industry, and so many tons of carbon can be emitted by somebody else. You can't translate that into a cost. So the politicians can say, well, we want to reduce our carbon emissions by such and such a percent. And usually it's a very minor amount. It's a small amount, because you have to do this incrementally or the market doesn't function. And if something happens that upsets the market, then the market doesn't work at all. And I'll give you an example. If one of the big scams, and I think most people acknowledge that this is a scam, other people would just say, well, it's a defect of the system. But so when you start a carbon trading program, most of the industries are grandfathered. Their businesses are already there. They're already spewing carbon into the atmosphere, and they're grandfathered. So they may have permits. They have permits, so they're issued permits. So then when the trading program begins, they can sell those permits. And you say, well, how do they sell those permits? And so when the program is launched, they have an initial pool of wealth that has accomplished nothing. So when you're trying to say, well, we're trying to efficient allocation of resources to do what we need to do, then we grant them permits when they haven't done anything. It's like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. And another example is, so we had the financial collapse in 2008. So a lot of people weren't driving their cars, or a lot of factories closed. So suddenly there were lots of permits available. So the carbon market collapsed in Europe. And everybody said, well, then we need to tighten up the cap on carbon emissions because, well, the carbon emissions are down. If we want to keep the trading program functioning, we have to tighten the screws on carbon because now so many factories are closed. But then that's a political decision, and they didn't do it, and the price of carbon collapsed. So you lost all this time since the financial collapse because the market hasn't functioned. And this is the kind of complexity that you get in a carbon trading program. So people like Charles Komenoff and myself and a lot of other economists suggest we just need a carbon tax. It's just so much more direct.
We're talking with Paul Graff. I got to apologize. I'm in L.A. It's like being in a being in a takeoff zone, landing zone at an airport. But so what makes you think that a carbon tax will do better than this cap and trade?
Well, there's a couple things that we need to talk about, Harvey, and I don't want to dwell too long on carbon tax and carbon trading. What I want to dwell on is the fact that there is a sentiment to take action. This sentiment has been growing despite the lack of discussion by the Republican presidential candidates, for example, despite the conservative rhetoric against addressing climate change, the conservative rhetoric against developing renewable energy, that there is a sentiment, even in the United States, that we need to develop renewable energy, that it makes sense, that it's economic now. Why don't we get going and do this? And now with
all
the
right,
government...
wait, I'm going to interrupt you one thing. You made a mistake of mentioning the Republican debate. I watched about 30 seconds of the Republican debate. Was it last night, two nights ago? I got literally nauseous. I mean, these guys can't seem to talk about anything except the four immigrants who come across the border every year, and then two of them go back. I mean, these guys are totally brain dead. And I think that if you went to the, a Republican, any one of these Republican candidates, and started talking about a carbon tax or the global warming issue, their eyes would glaze over. They don't know anything, these guys. I mean, to me, watching these Republicans was like watching a band of idiots running away from anything of substance. I got to say, I've never seen anything quite as pathetic as that Republican debate. And, you know, God forbid a topic of real substance like a carbon tax should enter into the debate, none of them would know anything. It's amazing to me.
Harvey, what's happening, though, is a positive in one way you look at it, and that is a lot of decent Republicans, critically thinking Republicans, are distancing themselves from the presidential candidates, and because they're embarrassed by what their party is proposing, and if the Republican Party is not careful, those kind of people that they need to win elections are going to drift away. But what I was trying to get at, Harvey, is that there is some positive momentum to develop renewable energy and to reduce the use of fossil fuels. Now, carbon tax or cap and trade does not develop renewable energy. This is a mistake of the environmental movement to think that if you have a cap and trade program or carbon tax, you're suddenly going to get renewable energy. Absolutely not. They are not connected. The only way they're connected is that if you increase the cost of fossil fuels, you may encourage more development of renewable energy, but not necessarily. You still need policies and programs that make development of renewable energy possible. So just having a carbon trading program or a cap and trade program or policies against the emissions of carbon dioxide are not sufficient. That's key that we have to understand.
All right, so we're going to take one more small detour, and then I want you to tell me what's going to happen with renewables. But we also had, of course, in Paris, the inevitable dog and pony show on nuclear. And, Charlie did, when he was on the program, point out that a carbon tax or cap and trade, although he washes his mouth out when he says the words cap and trade, could help nuclear. And we did have James Hansen and these other guys there. I did put up a piece who advocate nuclear. I did put up a piece at our radio station, PRN.org, the website called Is James Hansen Actually Anti-Nuclear? It was kind of a parody because, as you know, Paul, I'm sure you saw it, he and three other guys ran a piece saying that nuclear is the solution to global warming. And then in the piece, they mentioned that their plan in order to solve global warming was to build something like more than 110 commercial reactors every year until 2050. And I just thought that was so totally outrageous that I would assume it was a parody and that they were actually putting down nuclear. Of course, we know that's not the case. So do you think that a carbon tax, you've said it wouldn't automatically bring about renewables. Do you think that a carbon tax is going to actually help these guys advocate for nuclear?
Yes, I think it's the same, and would have the same effect on nuclear as renewables. I mean, if we have a higher price on emissions of carbons, it's going to make nuclear and renewables look better, because both nuclear and renewables emit no pollution at the source. Now, some renewables do, like biomass combustion, but not on the scale of burning fossil fuels. Yes, but I don't think we should.
Wait, Paul. Nuclear does emit pollution.
Yeah, I know. You were going to come back to that, but it's. I do study this, Harvey, and the total emissions from nuclear are pretty low in comparison to burning natural gas or any fossil fuels. So, actually, some of the studies. Anyway, you don't need to go down there. I don't want to focus on that. What I want to tell you and your listeners is that we shouldn't be too concerned about that, about James Hansen. James Hansen has done good work drawing the world's attention to climate change, drawing Americans' attention to climate change, standing up to the U.S. Congress when even up to this day, who don't want to admit that the United States is a major polluter in the global atmosphere. But when he talks about nuclear, he's off the wall and he's off base, but it's just not going to happen, and I don't think that we in the environmental community should spend a lot of time trying to rebut his arguments or even considering it, because it's just not going to happen. If you look what's happened to Electricité de Riva, the French European pressurized water reactor in Finland and in France itself, if they try to build these things, they're not going to build 100 of them per year. It's just not going to happen. They can't. We'd have to. It'd be such a level of subsidy that there would be such a huge outcry that I just don't see it happening anywhere. I mean, just look what the Brits are trying to do. What the Brits have to contort themselves to build two reactors in Britain. They are asking the French and the Chinese to build the reactors for them. Imagine that. Now, at some point, the British are going to say, well, this is really, what are we asking the French and the Chinese to do it?
Well, it's kind of fusion cuisine there.
Well, you just have to say, I mean, and it comes down to, why are the Brits doing this? Why are the British trying to build these reactors at all costs? It's going to be far more expensive than renewables are today to build these two reactors, and it comes down to they want to keep their Trident missile submarines in weapons. That's what it all comes down to. And, well, that we don't have logical arguments against, because it's not logical.
Yeah, logic kind of loses. It's like watching the Republican debate. Logic? What is logic? We're talking with Paul Guyp, one of the world's very, very top experts in renewable energy. And, what about this idea that Paris is really going to accelerate the run to renewables? What specifically do you have in mind that's going to come out of Paris that is going to make this thing really happen, this solartopian transition to a green powered Earth? What's the landmark?
Well, one is this idea that renewable energy is acceptable on a world stage. It's acceptable way to. It's so inexpensive now that we are foolish if we don't develop it. We have a crisis. We can respond to this crisis by developing something that's different than burning fossil fuels, and it's cheap, and there's acknowledgement. You know, we who work in this stuff, you know, we try to analyze all these reasons, and we look at questions logically and find technical solutions, and a lot of it is in the spirit and in the heart and in the sentiment, and that's part of what comes away from Paris. Maybe those who were there, they saw all the specifics, but those of us who sat aside and looked at it from afar said, wow, the people in Paris, this is something that the whole world watched, and the whole world watched these nations in Paris say, hey, we have to do something about it, and renewable energy is one of the ways we're going to do that. And what you've seen at Paris is another thing, is the confirmation of all these cities and some nations who have made commitments to become 100% renewable energy. Now, of course, it's going to happen to electricity first, but eventually we have to go to transportation and in heating, but it's going to happen in electricity first. That's the easiest thing to tackle.
I assume a lot of that momentum came from Germany.
Well, Germany, yes. Yes, it has, but also not just Germany. Remember Denmark. I mean, it's a small nation, but it's a nation that's had a big effect on the world's ability to look at renewable energy as though it, as in the way that it can affect change. And Denmark has a policy to be 100% renewable energy in transportation as well. You know, that means trains, that means private passenger vehicles, light-duty vehicles, and that means we're going to have to convert them to electricity, so that means electric cars. And Denmark has also means in home heating, in heating buildings, and Denmark has made great strides in that, something that we haven't done here in North America, and they have many of the villages and the cities have central heating plants, and the central heating plants heat the buildings. And that's, first of all, very efficient. And when you have that kind of heating system, that can be powered by solar energy, solar thermal energy, you know, solar panels that heat hot water.
Wow. And I got to point out, you know, the political dimension to this. That, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, there was movement in Denmark to build nuclear plants, and there was a green movement in Denmark, and they made a specific political victory to not build nuclear. And as a result of that, four of the major farm implement companies in Denmark went into wind and made a ton of money. And so this is a very, next door in Sweden, the green movement wasn't strong enough. They built 11 reactors, which they're now on the track of phasing out. So those of us who do this kind of political campaigning really can take heart from what happened in Denmark. It was not just accidental. They could have gone nuclear in Denmark, and the green movement did win that one. But
Harvey, because the way we got wind energy today was through the anti-nuclear movement in Denmark. The movement in Denmark, they popularized that slogan, the smiley sun face that said, "Atomkraft nein danke, atomkraft nei tak, no thank you." They developed wind energy. They built a giant turbine at the wind when Boeing and McDonnell Aircraft and GE couldn't build wind turbines. They built the wind turbine that is the direct ancestor of all the wind turbines we have today. And, you know, a lot of your listeners, I know you use the word solartopia, and a lot of people in the United States, they focus on renewable energy as a solar technology. It is not. Renewable energy is much more than just solar energy. It is also wind energy, it's biomass, and it's geothermal. We need all of these renewable technologies if we're to have solartopia.
Absolutely, and I got to point out, Paul, and I'm sure you've seen this, that it looks like we're finally going to get windmills in Lake Erie. There is a company that's moving ahead with it, and Lake Erie, if you look at the wind map, is about as good a wind site as you can possibly get, and in terms of being in the water, Lake Erie is shallow, and the sites are close to the cities, Cleveland, Toledo, Detroit, and so this is moving ahead. I read, and you're, of course, the great expert in wind, and maybe you can enlighten me on this. Someone has developed a better system of anchoring windmills to the ocean floor. The ones that, my understanding is the ones that are offshore in Europe, North Sea and the Baltic, are you know, the poles go all the way into the ocean floor, but these guys seem to have found a way to be a little more efficient in the anchoring. Am I missing something there?
No. That's floating. They call them floating offshore wind turbines. I'm not a particularly a strong proponent of offshore. I think it makes sense in a place like Lake Erie, Lake Ontario. I was hoping that the Canadians, Ontarians, in fact, would be the first to develop wind energy in the Great Lakes, but they stumbled badly, and maybe Ohio and New York State will actually do it first. But we have such great resources onshore that it's not something that I really focus on. And just to go back to mention what happened in Denmark about the citizens' movement to develop wind energy to show the Danish government that there was an alternative to nuclear power, and in fact that if the Danish government was not going to develop renewable energy, the people of Denmark would take renewable energy into their own hands and build their own wind turbines. And that story will be in my new book, Harvey, which will be out in the middle of 2016, because it's a very powerful story. It's a story that you and your listeners and anyone who's interested in Solartopia needs to know about.
Well, what's the title of your book, and tell us a bit more about it.
It's called Wind Energy for the Rest of Us, and that title says it all. And that is that wind energy can be used by all of us. It doesn't necessarily have to be developed by Florida Power and Light or Electricity de France. It can be built by people like us and has been developed by people like us. It's the reason we have wind energy today was because of Danish farmers, Danish activists took power into their own hands and built their own windmills, and that's why we have this huge multi-billion dollar global industry today, and we can do it again. The American people, Canadians, can build wind energy for their own benefit and the benefit of their community, and we can do that, and it doesn't have to be developed by Florida Power and Light or Electricity de France. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it that way. I'm saying there are many ways to develop renewable energy, but we should have the right. We as citizens should have the right to develop wind energy and solar energy for our benefit. And so my book, the theme is, it's got all the technical stuff, of course, but it's our, the theme is we can develop wind energy, we can own it, we can make money from it, and we can build a society or a solartopia that protects the planet and makes strong, healthy communities.
Well, and Paul, as I recall, you were one of the original hands-on builders of at least small windmills way back when. So what is it, Paul Geip, wind-works.org, is that right?
Correct.
Did I get that right?
What
is it about Paris? Why did we reach this turning point now? After all these years, all these, you know, Copenhagen and Kyoto and all these other meetings, Rio, why did we, what makes Paris different from all the other climate conferences? Let's put it that way.
Well,
and why?
One
why
is,
did it happen now?
Well, one is the technology exists today. I mean, we people like myself have been arguing the technology has always been there. We just need to use it on a grand scale to get the cost down. And while we now are developing wind and solar energy on such a great scale, whether it's in Germany or China or United States or Canada, that the costs have come down so much that now people can say we have a crisis. There's a consensus that something weird is happening in the world. I'm in central Indiana right now, and it was 70 degrees here yesterday. It was colder in Bakersfield, California than it was in central Indiana. Now, that's weird. Buffalo, New York hasn't had any snow yet this winter. That's weird. Weird stuff is going on, more so than in the past. There's a general sentiment, even among some of the politicians who don't want to do anything, that something weird is happening. And there is alternatives. There's another way of doing it. And that there's a sentiment now, and of course we as activists have been waving our placards and lobbying in the halls of our Congress or in the Parliament in Ottawa, Canada, or in Paris or in Berlin, saying that these things can be done and we need to do something, so let's do this. And I think that these are all coming together at a one time. Now, this is not going to happen overnight. I mean, it's taken us three decades to get to this point, but we are making progress, and this was a turning point. I think that's the word to use. Paris was a turning point.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I flew from Columbus, Ohio, yesterday, leaving 60-degree weather, and landed in L.A., and last night, there was frost on the windows. It was in the low 30s. I want my money back, actually.
we tried to leave Bakersfield, California yesterday, and there was frost on the airplane, so they had to bring out the de-icer. Now, Bakersfield, California, they don't use the de-icer very often, and it didn't work. And here's an example of Solartopia at work. So we had to wait until the sun came up before we could fly away.
That's amazing. That's pretty amazing. Yeah, I mean, it is cold here in L.A. What can I tell you? So this turning point, Paul, do you expect now a major takeoff in renewables? I mean, I tell people that photovoltaic cells, and I'm a big fan of wind, but I tell people that photovoltaics will be the biggest industry in the history of the world, that more money will be spent on photovoltaic cells in the long run than on any other invention that human beings have made. Because every building, every piece of equipment, every vehicle will have some form of PV on it at some point in time. That's my thing. I mean, am I wrong?
No, I think it's going to be a huge industry. But I think that you and I both have a responsibility to remind people that if we want to have an integrated energy system, that we need all the renewable technologies and not just solar. Solar can't do it alone, and in fact, if we try to do it alone with solar, the system becomes so complex and so expensive that it makes those fossil fuels look attractive, and we don't need that. What we need is a mix of resources so that we can eliminate fossil fuels, and we can do that if we use wind and solar together, and that's why we need all of these technologies, but primarily we need wind and solar. Those are the two big ones that are going to make such a huge difference. This is happening now. Today, when you look at what's happening in China, China is... For all the talk about the coal plants China's building and all the nuclear plants China building, they are building tens of thousands of megawatts of wind turbines and solar panels. I think three or four or five of the top 10 wind companies in the world are all Chinese. We wouldn't know that, but that's because they build so many wind turbines. Tens of thousands of wind turbines megawatts of wind turbines will be installed in China this year. So this is happening. It can happen even bigger and can be developed more rapidly than we ever thought possible. This is where James Hansen is wrong. He says, well, solar can't scale and wind can't scale. I say, what? The role of regulators in California, this is the problem with an RPS system, the role of regulators in California is to clamp down on the development of solar and wind energy. They don't want it to grow too fast. I'm saying, whoa, what's too fast? We need fast. Fast is good.
Yes, and you know, we're running out of time with it, so I didn't want to reach. I can't resist this. You know, I write on the Internet. You write on the Internet. We get these comments. So I got a comment, Paul. This is, you have to take this seriously. Someone wrote in and said that they're opposing solar because the panels will absorb too much energy from the sun, and the sun will cease to exist. Now, can you address that?
Very quickly, Harvey, I mean, I looked into that incident in, I think it was North or South Carolina, and it was two people, and, you know, every community has their nutcases, and one of these people was a retired science teacher, and you say, woo, I wonder what kind of science they taught there at that school.
Really?
Yeah, but most of the communities, in the end, when you read the actual original news story, they didn't like it because it wasn't their solar plant. And they were getting no benefits from the solar plant. They weren't paying any taxes. They weren't paying any royalties. They just had to look at them. And I'm saying that problem would not have existed if those solar plants were developed by the community themselves and owned by the community. And those people had went to that town council meeting and stood up and said, we want to build this solar plant. The counselors would have voted for it and told the two people that objected because it was going to steal the sun, told them they were crazy.
Right. Well, we got two other ones. I'll zip through real quick. Somebody wrote me once and said that he was against wind because it would slow down the rotation of the Earth.
And then, oh yeah, well, I've heard that one. I've heard that one too. But we're still going. We're still going okay.
Yeah, we're doing all right. And the other one, I just got this one yesterday or 2 days ago. Said that they were against solar because the solar panels absorb too much of the sunlight and will heat up the Earth. And what you have to do is paint all your rooftops white so that we can reflect the sun back out. But anyway, is photovoltaic, is the production of photovoltaic cells simple enough, accessible enough that small communities can actually build PV manufacturing plants?
Well, not necessarily PV manufacturing plants, but they can build the power plants themselves. That's the beauty of PV. It comes in small units. You know, each panel is only like 300 watts or so. So you can mix and match panels to build any size power plant that you want. And, of course, solar panels can be put on your rooftop or the top of your factory building. That's the beauty of solar. You can't do that with windmills, of course. Windmills are a much bigger thing. They're a mechanical device as opposed to a semiconductor. But one of the things that you can do with solar is in all parts of the world, you can build these factories because the materials that you use are pretty simple. You know, it's sand, basically, sand, and you can build a factory to build these things in parts of Africa, and then you can distribute those solar panels to the villages in Africa. You don't have to build a power plant and string long cables to these villages. You can just ship them the solar panels.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. I mean, it's kind of like cell phones. Well, I have read in a number of countries in Africa or regions where they don't have strung wires for telephones. They've just not bothered. They've gone straight to cell phones. And that will certainly happen with not building electric grids in places that are going to electrify with solar, the big, big plus. We're talking with Paul Geip, wind-works.org is his website. New book is Solar Power for the Rest of Us. It'll be out in 2016, right, Paul?
Right. Wind Energy for the Rest of Us, 2016.
Oh, wind
correct.
Energy for the Rest of Us. Okay. all right. Well, there you go. Well, the wind is a form of solar. So, you know. Now, the other thing, the other thing that's missed in all this and really pisses me off is when the advocates of nuclear come out and they say, well, we have this demand curve, and obviously renewables can't keep up with the demand curve. But the demand curve is not set in stone. You know, it's not the 11th commandment that thou shalt consume so much energy. And the flip side, the good flip side of the renewable revolution is LED and the massive increases in energy efficiency. And maybe you know the answer to this. Somebody told me that the LED technology, the way it works, is actually the flip side of photovoltaics. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true, Harvey. And we're going to need to go soon because I'm happen to be on one of these here radio phones, and it's going to die on me. But what I can tell you that in my new book, Wind Energy for the Rest of Us, will be out in mid-2016. There's a whole section in the book on how we integrate renewable energy, not just wind energy, but how we integrate renewable energy into the grid. And a lot of the things that we've been taught about how we use the grid and why wind energy and solar energy won't work are, of course, false, and they're simply myths, and that we don't need the kind of storage that we've been told we need for 30 years. Once we have storage, we can develop renewable energy. That's simply not true. We don't need that much storage, particularly if we develop so much wind and solar energy.
Right, and of course the irony is we're about to get that much storage. I mean, Elon Musk and Tesla are building a multi-billion-dollar facility in Nevada to bang out the batteries and go in our basements.
Yeah, it'll still be helpful. It'll be helpful, Harvey. It's helpful, but it's not necessary, and that's the key thing. It can make it work better, but it's not necessary, and that's what's most important. The energy transition, the renewable energy revolution, does not have to wait for energy storage. We need and can develop renewable energy today. We need to strive for 100% renewable energy so that we can reduce our consumption of fossil fuels and control climate change.
All right, buddy. Well, maybe next time we can talk about this LED thing. I love LED light, and I don't exactly understand the physics of how they would be the flip side of photovoltaics in terms of moving the electrons around. But I think LED lighting, in a certain sense, is right up there with wind and solar as part of the solartopian transition. I mean, there's something really transcendental about LED lighting that's changing a lot of things. I assume it has a component somewhere in heating as well.
Well, we haven't got there yet, but one of the things that we can talk about in the future is, of course, we have been talking primarily about the electricity system, but we need to talk about transportation. We must electrify the transportation system, particularly in places like the United States and Canada, where so much of our transportation is passenger vehicles, personal cars, passenger vehicles, and we need to convert those to electric. And, of course, as you know, we now drive an electric car, and I'm always happy to talk about what it's like to own and operate an electric car in California.
Well, how do you like it?
Well, it's fun. It's one of the things most people don't think. They have this image of an electric car as this little thing, and it barely moves. No, an electric car is fun to drive. Ask anybody who's driven a Tesla, and they'll tell you, well, that is some car. We don't drive a Tesla. We drive what we would call a mass-market electric car, a Nissan Leaf. And it's fun to drive. But the main reason you should drive an electric car, one, it's a lot cheaper to drive because the electricity is still cheap, and because there's no emissions from the tailpipe. And if you live like we do in the oil capital of California, in the most polluted place in North America, it's really important that you don't have any emissions from the tailpipe, and electric vehicles don't have any emissions from the tailpipe. I mean, that's it. It's more efficient use of resources to drive an electric car than it is to drive a gasoline-powered car.
Absolutely. And plus, there's no maintenance.
We took it in for the one-year battery maintenance check. It was free. That's the only time we've been to the shop. Nothing. That's it.
So you didn't change your oil and do the spark plugs?
When I called to set up the appointment, Harvey, the guy says, oh, well, we can change the oil. I said, this is an electric car. And so there was no cost to us, nothing. Of course, it's a brand-new car. You wouldn't expect anything to go wrong, but we don't expect to have anything done to this car in the 3 years we will own it.
Well, my son-in-law got an electric car, and he wears a hat. And the guy hit the accelerator, and his hat flew into the back seat. So there you go. You're probably out drag racing in Bakersfield and leaving everybody in the dust. We've been talking with Paul Guype. His phone's about to die. Author of a new book, Wind Power for the Rest of Us, coming out in 2016. Wind-works.org is his website. Paul, you're a tremendous resource. And I guess we do really have to celebrate Paris. I'm glad to hear from you why it's qualitatively different. I got a sense that it's qualitatively different, and I think, and this is one thing we've been talking about with Solartopia, is what's happening, is nobody's talking about, is that the industries... We'll take this up again. Thank you, crew in New York. Thank you, Paul Guype. And we'll be back with
Solartopia. Good day. Bye now.
All right, buddy. You too, man. Always a pleasure. We'll be back with Solartopia next week. See you in Solartopia.
So